Let's start off with the following problem. I find these two comments difficult to recognize, reconcile. These are both Wittgenstein's views about mathematics during the period 1929 and 1944. There can't be two independent proofs of one mathematical proposition. And second one, of course, it would be nonsense to say that one proposition cannot have two proofs, for we do say just that. Felix has done very important work on this passage, which I was not aware of when I wrote this this stuff. And if there's time, I will do my best to react to some of the things that he said in his important commentary on the remarks of the Foundation of Mathematics. Now, what's more striking than this, I call this logical tension, other people less charitable might call this a contradiction, is what seems to be a contradiction in his view about the relationship between mathematics and its applications. Is from philosophical grammar, it might look as though the mathematical computation 3 times 3 plus 2 equals 11 entitled us to make a prediction, say, that I could give 3 people their share and maybe 2 apples left over, but that isn't so. What justifies us in making this prediction is that hypothesis of physics, which lies outside the calculation. He actually said that. That's in the early 30s. And he said, on the one hand, it seems to me that you can develop arithmetic completely autonomously and its application takes care of itself, since wherever it's applicable, we may also apply it. On the other hand, the nebulous introduction of the concept of number by means of the general form of operation such as I gave can't be what is needed. You could say, why bother to limit the application of arithmetic? That takes care of itself. I can make a knife without bothering what sorts of material it will cut. That will show soon enough. But as we all know well, arithmetic, when he says as we all know well, he's talking about himself, he's writing to himself. He means all of the Wittgenstein, the good Wittgenstein, the bad Wittgenstein. Arithmetic isn't at all concerned about its application. Its applicability takes care of itself. But in 1939, Wittgenstein gave lectures on the foundations of mathematics at Cambridge. These have 2 major advantages for me. First of all, he's actually not writing a notebook, he's actually talking to students. And number 2, of course, in English. And so I have a better understanding of what he's saying. In German, I have some problems about how do you say application. There's some question here about use, application, and it gets involved in both semantics and philosophy, because what, but in English, he said the following. By the way, he said it according to Cora Diamond, right? Okay, so the question is, do you believe Cora Diamond? Cora Diamond had these notebooks and had the scientific idea that you take the 3. If 2 out of 3 said the same thing, then Wittgenstein said, all right, those of us who know a little bit more about this subject will be skeptical, but I personally, and I think Felix also agrees that the spirit you see, you actually hear Wittgenstein saying these things. I personally think she did a good job, but you could disagree. So according to Cora Diamond, he said, many intelligent people were shocked when the expression imaginary numbers was introduced. It is a harmless misunderstanding because the interest of mathematicians or physicists is chiefly the practical application of it, the application of physics. On the other hand, if you can show there are numbers bigger than the infinite, your head whirls. This may be the chief reason this was invented. You hear this? Cantor invented the theory of infinite cardinals to make your head whirl. It has no other use. Set theory has no other use than making your head whirl. The interest is centered entirely on the words which accompany the piece of mathematics you make. We actually told this to students in 1939. And as a matter of fact, my friend, or I shouldn't say, my mentor, Hilary Putnam, got so disgusted with this kind of stuff that he has become what we say in Yiddish, an ois Wittgensteiner, left the fold in one of his many stages. He doesn't like what, but what is Wittgenstein saying? First of all, he obviously sees such an antipathy to Cantor to such a degree that there are some misguided souls who thought that he was some kind of self-hating anti-Semite. He just couldn't stand Cantor, who was himself an apostate Jew. I mean, I've seen this stuff. When I get this as an editor, I immediately reject these kind of articles. Because there's articles that also say that Wittgenstein hated Gödel because he was a self-hating Jew. Now, the author of that article knew that Gödel was not Jewish. Nevertheless, the argument was, we know that Russell thought that Gödel was Jewish. He actually writes that Gödel was Jewish. And what was the proof that Gödel was Jewish? Because he's running around in Vienna with all kinds of Jews. So therefore, Gödel must have also been Jewish by the transitivity principle. And Russell thought that, and Wittgenstein certainly should have said, this is the kind of argumentation that we have. I was happy to say that I rejected this article for publication. At any rate, he did hate, as a matter of fact, he always hated Cantor's set theory. It's not a good word to be said in either the so-called early or the late, but what's interesting in this is that the focus of this animus is on applications. Here's the first time, he has all kinds of things to say that set theory is no good, but here he's saying it has no applications. Now he believed this falsehood. If you want to, say something nice, give him the benefit of the doubt. Unfortunately, there's a lot of mathematicians who think the same thing. We can prove that by, I'm not talking about Berkeley, I'm talking about other places like Columbia University. I won't give set theorists a job in the math department. This is well known. Only in our university. Our university was basically founded, math department was founded first by Edmund Landau, a great figure of Göttingen, and then Adolf Frankel, one of the founders of set theory, and he made sure that set theory is considered mathematics in our place, and there's some great, thank God, there's a lot of good set theorists around in our university. The president, actually, of the university, Menachem Maggador, was one of the most prominent set theorists in the world. Now, so what I'm saying here is not that it's against Cantor and set theory, but that the focus here becomes on applications. What happened to the application supposed to take care of itself? He says, later, this already, we're talking about the 40s now. It's very important to get your dates right. A lot of literature on the later Wittgenstein is very loose on when he said what. I try to make a little more sense by using this Nachlas, where actually got a grant that was willing to give me 10,000 shekels, or around at that time $3,000, to get a few discs. And I tried to use them in order to date some of these statements. There's no such thing in my, the whole thing, if they stop me, there's no such thing as the early Wittgenstein or the late Wittgenstein. That's a straitjacket that prevents people from actually thinking what happened during the 30s. And as I said, this lecture is in a fractal style. I can stop at any word without any loss of information whatsoever. So I really don't care. If I run out of time, I'll stop and eat. I won't say, give me two more sentences or another part. Okay. Here it is. It's used outside mathematics. And so the meaning of the sign make the sign gave into mathematics. What happened? I find it difficult to reconcile what he said with the statement we saw before. Arithmetic is an old conservative idea that applicability takes care of itself. I put it to you, any scholar who tries to make these things say the same thing is not doing good scholarship. You have to sometimes face facts. Now, here's another example in the same period. What does it mean to obtain a new concept of the surface of a sphere? How is it then a concept of surface of the sphere? Only so far as it can be applied to real spheres. Huh? Is this Wittgenstein? Yeah. Wittgenstein in the 40s. You could say the very meaning of the mathematics given by the canonical applications. What's so bad about this is he sounds like he's giving the essence of mathematics. And Wittgenstein is an anti, essentially, what happened to family resemblance why is he removing set theory from the realm of mathematics just because it has no canonical application, right? So Wittgenstein himself is bothered by this, and here I'm not looking for consistency. He has this dialectical argument with himself. If the intended application of mathematics is essential, as he just said, how about parts of mathematics' application, or at least what mathematicians take for their application, is quite fantastic. So that, as it said here, when it's doing a branch of mathematics, of whose application one forms an entirely false idea. Question is, what's the true idea? I think you thought it was wallpaper. You have to think about putting doing mathematics on the wall, doing wallpaper. Now, isn't one doing mathematics nonetheless? As usual, these questions have no answer. But then he comes back to himself and says, how is it possible to have a concept and not be clear about its application? Imagine someone who believes that mathematicians have discovered a clear thing, the square root of minus one, which when squared does yield minus one. Can't he nevertheless calculate quite well with complex numbers and apply such calculations in physics? And does this make them any less calculations? In those lectures already in 1939, he distinguished the complex analysis from set theory, which has, quote, no applications. Complex analysis does have, he knew about those applications as an engineer, does have applications, but in hydrodynamics there are some very useful applications of the complex numbers, which I think that Wittgenstein knew about. The flow of water is well described by complex analysis. So he says, that's okay, right? That has applications, that's not metaphysics like set theory. Everything I say really amounts to this, that one can know a proof thoroughly and follow it step by step, but yet at the same time not understand what it was that was proved. Wow. This doesn't sound like Wittgenstein in the 30s. And this in turn is connected with the fact that one can perform a mathematical proposition in a grammatically correct way without understanding its meaning. Okay. Now when does one understand it? I believe when one can apply it. What happened? I came all this way to persuade Felix that something happened. I don't know if I'll succeed, but this whole lecture is on that. I'm like Wittgenstein trying to persuade Turing in 1939. I can only persuade Turing that I'm right. I don't give a damn about the other. Who cares about Norman Malcolm? Well, it was Turing. And when Turing wasn't there 1 week, he refused to lecture. He said, there's no point in lecturing with Turing. He's a real mathematician. So we want to I want to convince him that he is violating his own ordinary language of mathematics. Okay. Well, here we go. This is the 40s. I mean, unless you really want to stand on your head, I say you can't at all reconcile these views with the views of the early 30s. Maybe. It would take a better Talmudist than I to show that really they're saying the same thing. And I'm a Talmudist, and I have to. I tried, I was not able to get there. So we have to say that he changed his mind. Now, you might say, this is part of the Talmudic dialectics to alleviate this contradiction. You might say that Wittgenstein is talking about two different authors, really. When he talks about applications in the 30s, he's talking about a different concept of application than in the 40s. And he's attacking two different kinds of people. In denying that mathematics has any essential connection to application, he might be attacking Frege. Frege insisted that we need a logical theory of the applicability of arithmetic, second order logic, so that applicability becomes nothing but substitution. You don't know, I'm sure many people know exactly what I'm talking about here. When even 2 + 2 = 4 turns out to be some complicated second order formula for all f, like for all, so you substitute something like f is the concept of an apple, and then you can, so 2 + 2 = 4 is sort of regimented out of any recognition. Right. So it could be that when Wittgenstein was talking about the applicability takes care of itself, he's talking about Frege. It's absolutely true, by the way. It's easy to prove this by looking around who he's talking about. Now, what about the 40s? In asserting that the meaning of mathematics is given by the canonical application, which we just saw, he might be attacking somebody else. Who is that person? Well, I actually made a prediction which turned out to be correct. I'm very proud of that, like a minor prophet. I thought he was talking about Hardy. Hardy was, of course, a great British mathematician who also was at Cambridge, and we know that Wittgenstein respected, etc. And Hardy had this idea, you know, like a super duper Platonist, really. I mean, there's nobody more than out-Plato or Plato. Because Hardy said that mathematics isn't even supposed to have applications. Plato never said that. Mathematics does have them, you have to understand why it has applications. Hardy says if it has application, it's not mathematics. Well, that was an unfortunate statement. You can explain why. It had to do with his anti-war stance, you know, applications mean you can kill people with mathematics, etc. So he gave an example of something that's pure mathematics that would never have any application. E equals mc squared. Exactly, the best example. But he had this view. Once you sully mathematics with applications, it's not mathematics. Mathematics, by definition, is beautiful, pristine, etc. He has a whole book about this called A Mathematician's Apology. All right, so we have two different figures that Wittgenstein might be attacking. One Frege, one extreme, and Hardy. It's easy to work out for homework which concept of application is involved. One in the 30s, one in the 40s. I wrote a book on this where one of the chapters, I distinguished four different notions of applicability. So even if you don't agree with the major thrust of the book, I hope you could learn from that chapter where I actually did the first in history of actually trying to figure out what it actually means when you four different applications. So, if you have different, as Aristotle said, right, if you have different concepts, there may not be a contradiction in what Wittgenstein is saying, given that he's talking about a different level. That won't work. I tried that. That won't work. Because
First of all, we have the following statement in the remark. I mean, I don't think you could do this this logic on that kind of statement. The geometrical illustration of analysis is indeed essential. And the German says, sorry about my pronunciation, unwesentlich. Not, however, the geometrical application. Originally, the geometrical illustrations were applications of analysis. Where they cease to be this, they can be wholly misleading. What we have then is the imaginary application, the fanciful application. The idea of a cut is one such dangerous illustration. Those who know what a Dedekind cut is, you know. Those who don't, I'm not going to give a course on Dedekind cuts, but it's the foundation of analysis from the 19th century. Dedekind made up this idea that a real number, you take the rationals, you make a cut, and the cut itself is the real number. Now, I had a strong feeling that this remark about, and remarks that follow about Dedekind's theory, or directed actually harder, the Cambridge mathematician who Wittgenstein regards as paradigmatic. And what Hardy and Turing and others said were important to Wittgenstein because they were not professional philosophers. He didn't care what professional philosophers said. But if a mathematician says something, and speaking for the mathematics profession, then Wittgenstein is not supposed to interfere with their language game. He's a non-revisionist. And I agree with Felix that he really meant it, so he didn't just say it, he actually meant to be. But here you have a problem, right? You have this mumbo-jumbo Dedekind cut, right? So how can you not interfere with what they said? So what did he do? His strategy was to accuse them of being corrupted by academic philosophy, so their realistic utterances don't really reflect the essence of mathematics. And it turned out, I made a minor discovery, but most of my discoveries have been made already before me, that Wittgenstein at the same time was annotating his copy of G.H. Hardy in the margin. He had a copy. Now, this is, I thank Felix for this, through Juliet Floyd. I didn't actually ask directly permission. I'm not publishing this last commission either. They're working on these annotations. They're writing a whole article on this. It's a very small aspect of these annotations. But look, I'll turn it around. Using electronics, you can actually rotate this thing. And you will see that this is exactly the same comment as appears in the remarks on the foundations of mathematics that I quoted before. Namely, the geometrical illustration of analysis is indeed unwesentlich, not, however, the geometrical application. This is one of the few times in the history of philosophy that a philosopher actually made a correct empirical prediction. Turns out that I was right on the head. Now, we still haven't solved the problem, because remember, Wittgenstein had earlier prepared mathematics to rules of grammar, and he said, grammar is not, now we're getting back to the early late Wittgenstein, like the late Schoner. Grammar is not accountable for reality. It's grammatical rules that determine meaning, and so they themselves are not answerable to any meaning. And to that extent, they're arbitrary. Huh? Well, grammar is not accountable to any reality, then it's grammatical rules that determine the meaning, and they themselves are, that's the slide. Yet, in remarks on the foundation of mathematics, part 5, in earlier texts, it's clear that that's no longer the case, since the applications, as we have seen, give the meaning to the mathematical calculus, and set theory, for example, doesn't have any application, so it's meaningless. I'm using that in a very broad which is, I don't say meaningless, but he says it's something that's invented just, right? It's like people, nasty people say about philosophy, they define it as a misuse of terminology that was invented for that purpose. And that's exactly what Wittgenstein is saying about set theory. I mean, if you want to call it mathematics, go right ahead, right? I'm not making appointments in the math department. Now, obviously, according to mathematics, if we assume that Wittgenstein underwent some kind of continuous development, there's a theorem of mathematics called the intermediate value theorem that says if a function is plus one place and minus another, it must have crossed the x-axis. Like, it has to be zero somewhere. So when did this happen? Well, first of all, before asking when did it happen, let's try to understand better what happened. My answer is, Wittgenstein rethought, this is the official answer, Wittgenstein rethought the relation between mathematics and empirical regularities. Pardon the mispronunciation, Regelmäßigkeit. In fact, empirical regularities became a central motive not only in Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics, but in his entire philosophy. I still had a grant, so I hired a graduate student, flew into Germany to look at the Nachlass, and I asked them to find the expressions like Regelmäßigkeit, and you see they cluster around the period we're talking about. What period? 36, 37. You have a peak in this kind of, actually published this, I'll have to do this more scientifically and hire a statistician, but it seems, if you look at it, you see he starts using this word all the time. And not only in philosophy and mathematics. And how do I explain this? This is connected with the fact that his later philosophy is centered on the concept of rule following. This is what I accept. I think he's right, quickly 100% right. And language games, right? Language games, rule following. Now, his philosophy of mathematics always saw mathematical theorem as rules. Some things in Wittgenstein, the formulation doesn't change, but the meaning undergoes, you have to be careful, he uses the same expression, but he might mean something different from it in his later period. The nature of the rules of mathematics changed in his mind. This is my thesis. That's why this revolution is concealed, because he continues always speaking of mathematics as rules, but it's the nature of the rule that has changed. Let me talk about his general philosophy first. Empirical regularities in philosophy in general. In the philosophical investigation, behavioral empirical regularity is the basis of every language. Suppose you came as an explorer into an unknown country with a language quite strange to you. In what circumstances did you say that the people that gave orders understood them, obeyed them, rebelled against them, blah, blah, blah? This is Wittgenstein's version of Gabba Ga, those who read Word and Object, a radical translation. Except that Quine only allows you to say, Wittgenstein allows you to jump up and down, hit you on the head, and other, a bigger repertoire behavior. But he comes up with the same idea. Rebin used to call this the odd couple, Quine and Wittgenstein. The common behavior of mankind is a system of reference by which we interpret an unknown language. It's an extremely important fact about Wittgenstein's philosophy. Let us imagine that the people in that country carried on the usual human activities and in the course of them employed apparently in a particular language. If we watch their behavior, we find it intelligent. It seems logical. But when we try to learn their language, we find it impossible to do so. in Davidson is turning to the grave. There is no regular connection between what they say, the sounds they make, and their actions. But still, these sounds are not superfluous. For if we gag, one of the people has the same consequences as with us. Without the sounds, their actions fall into confusion. And he adds the usual, as I feel like putting it. He doesn't actually say it, but he feels like saying it. Are we to say that these people have a language, orders, reports, and the rest? There is not enough regelmäßigkeit for us to call it language. It's the basic idea. Now, I have to be careful. What do I mean by rule? I'm talking about behavioral rules. Like, what's in Horowitz with quoted? I don't think that Wittgenstein was behaviorist at all. At the same time, there is a behavioral underpinning to everything else. And everything else is supervenient in the lingo today on this. And if you don't have the behavioral regularity, you can't have any, no language in society and no mathematics, as we will see. Let's talk about rule following, for example, before we get to mathematics. A much clearer description of the so-called rule following paradox is given in remarks, not in philosophical investigations, but actually in remarks in the Foundation of Math, part 6, much clearer what he's saying. How can I follow a rule when after all, whatever I do can be interpreted as following? It is true that anything can somehow be justified, but the phenomenon of language is based on regularity, on agreement in action, not opinions, but action. No, not in judgment. Here it is the greatest important that all of us, or the enormous majority of us, agree in certain things. I can, e.g., be quite sure that the color of this object will be called green by far the most of the human beings who see it. He's talking about what Skinner calls a response, green. This is a particular experiment. What experiment? He was thinking about throughout all the 30s. I'm not arguing that this appears here. But all the strands came together in what I'm calling his revolution in philosophy of mathematics. I'm skipping a lot of stuff about Kripke because of time pressure. I have a whole thing about where Kripke got it right, where Kripke got it wrong, etc. I will just say briefly what I think he's saying about the rule-following paradox. I don't know how brief this is, but we have to understand what a paradox is and the difference between a paradox and a skeptical argument. Just skepticism of the type of Descartes, Sextus, empiricus, and the other people who have been mentioned, I think, correctly at this conference. A paradox is a special form of argument where you start off with propositions that are accepted by everybody, or seem to be, have no problem with them, they're unexceptional, like Zeno's paradox. I mean, movement, you have Achilles, the tortoise, that can catch up, etc., the arrow moves. And yet, when you start looking at it, the thing blows up into a disaster. That's a paradox. Now, to get out of a paradox, you have to show the argument is invalid. Or, as in a wonderful article by Quine, How Quaint the Ways of Paradox, you have to revise, you have to make a fundamental revision so that disaster won't happen. Russell thought that the modern theory of infinite cardinals by Cantor solves Zeno's paradoxes. That's actually wrong. As Kripke has pointed out correctly, it's a theory of ordinals that solve the problem, but we will not go into that. Now, what's the paradox of rule following? The paradox of rule following would have to be starting from ordinary propositions that we all accept, and that's strange propositions like, I don't know what a regularity is. Now, you're not allowed to start with that type of thing. You have to get into a situation in which the thing blows up on you. Wittgenstein's response to this is that if you stick with ordinary descriptions of ordinary behavior, it will blow up, because we have these regularities. Everybody who's trained in arithmetic behaves more or less the same way, and those who don't, you say that they have a low IQ, and society denies them entry into places like Göttingen and the University of Peking, because they don't have scholastic aptitude. So that's, but most people do the same thing. That thing is now judged as the norm. That's the basic idea. Now, if a person, you know the thing about 2, 4, 6, 8, up to 2,000, and say, how do you know what the right answer is? Now, first of all, in that period, Wittgenstein says, no is a no-no. This is not something that we know at all. It's all come together with this other stuff, our knowledge. It's irrelevant to talk about knowledge here. On the other hand, by looking at his behavior up to now, it's obvious that he's doing plus 2 and not plus plus or whatever, anything else, because that's the majority of people who are trained this way, that's what they do. They're doing this function, not that function. Anything that goes beyond this description is not accepting it as a paradox. You're trying to do a skeptical argument, which Wittgenstein is not doing. The skeptical argument only follows from his enemies. Who's his enemies, Wittgenstein? Everybody. Academic philosophy in general. He didn't like academic philosophy. I'm glad that you used the expression academic philosophy, because that I've been using it for years. I actually found a letter in which he talked about the term academic philosophy. In the Nachlass, it does not appear, so I felt bad. But there's a letter not in the Nachlass, which he inveighs against academic philosophy. Academic philosophy, I can, for the purposes of lecture, define as everybody. Or everybody in the history of philosophy who tried to give philosophical explanations for things that have to be just accepted. So that's everybody. In mathematics, you have Plotinus, which tries to explain the agreement of behavior and behavioral regularities among mathematicians, how they don't come to blows, there's no wars fought about mathematical theorem. That's not true, but he thought, just in those times, there's a war between Hilbert and Brouwer. Remember Brouwer? He had this intuitionism, and Hilbert got rid of him by the usual academic methods. He wrote an article and made sure that he wasn't funded. That was the end of intuitionism. But that's the ball game here. So you have, getting back to the idea. The idea is very simple. There's no paradox if you can't make the thing blow up into a disaster by simple description. When you do Platonism, it does blow up, because now you're investing in the idea that you have to explain why people follow this rule rather than the other. And as I think Kripke's book does show, that there isn't any such fact. There's no fact characteristic, and this is Wittgenstein's idea. So if you're looking for one, you won't find it. Same thing, mentalism. You won't find that either. You won't find any kind of mental state which you could identify with following the rule plus rather than plus. This is a long discussion, which I won't go into. Some of Kripke's arguments here are good, some are bad. The bad one is the infinity argument, but I will not. I just want to ask me about why I think it's a bad one. I'll talk about it later. But the basic idea is right. As long as you just describe what's happening in terms of regularities that we've been trained into, right, and don't try to do stupid Moore-type skepticism, you won't get into a disaster. A paradox can only happen if you start with ordinary descriptions of things and then end them in disaster. And that's the idea. It doesn't happen. Wittgenstein even answers the question. Aloys, right? Mentioned this very important passage. I always get asked this in my class. My students always ask me, "I'm being circular." Then I'm defining order and rule by means of regularity. Wittgenstein doesn't answer this directly. He says, "How do I explain the meaning regularly, uniform, same to everybody?" The same thing, right? As you train people, you train them to follow rules, but at the same time, you're training them to identify rules. You're training what meaning the same is, right? Now, if you go beyond that and say, how do you know that it's the same or not same? You're going far beyond. This kind of question is completely incoherent with Wittgenstein. There may be a transcendental element here, namely some kind of implicit argument that we couldn't speak at all if there weren't regularities, therefore since we're speaking there are regularities. I will leave this to Kantian scholars, but that's the idea. You teach everybody in a global picture, you teach them how to follow a rule, what the meaning of a rule is, how to identify rules, and since rules and the same are the same thing, you're teaching them what the same means. And that's the only way to teach them. There's no level beyond it. Sort of like your Berlitz. In the course of teaching, I'll just show them the same code and the same language, and blah, blah, blah. And he explains what he did in, by the way, people don't talk about the fact that he was a school teacher in Austria, right after he had solved all the problems. You know that he taught arithmetic in the third grade in a classroom in Austria? You can't understand philosophical investigations without actually hearing him teach these kids. When he says, when somebody I'm afraid of tells me, what's the next number, right? He won't say 20 to 2007. He won't be a wise guy. Wittgenstein is known to have exercised violence on the students in training them in the algorithms of arithmetic. However, there's one thing you can say for him. He beat the girls as mercilessly as he beat the boys. He thought that they were just as qualified to do mathematics as the boys. If you want to say something nice about him, you can say that. All right. Anyhow, it took a lot of time. I'm claiming that circularity in this question of rules and regularity only on views of academic philosophy. In Wittgenstein's descriptive philosophy, these kind of circularity doesn't arise because only one package. Imagine witnessing such teaching, none of the words are explained by me, no logical circle. That's a key point in the whole philosophical investigation. And it's a key to his later philosophy of mathematics. Now we can understand what he says about mathematics. We have invented multiplication up to 100. That is, we've written things like 81 times 63, but we've never yet written down things like 123 times 489. I say to the trainee, you know what you've done so far, do the same thing, right? Now, if he's an academic philosopher or a wise guy, he'll say, oh, I don't know what you mean by the same thing. He said, boom, you know what I mean, do it. I assume he does what you usually do. Wittgenstein made sure that he did. This is an experiment, and one which we may later adopt as a calculation. Since he got 99% of the class to say the answer, and everybody, every teacher, let's face it, I mean, we don't hit the kids, but we deny scholarships and a lot of stuff that we do, right? We make fun of them at conferences, a lot of things that you can do short of beating people to the ground. Philosophers know how to do this very well. And what we're trying to do is eliminate as far as possible the deviation from the regularity. Now, once you have a good regularity like that, that becomes what we call a calculation. Then there's a right and wrong answer. What does that mean? This is what he said in the lectures on foundation. He said it to students, right? Well, suppose that 90% do it all one way. I say, this is not going to be the right result. The experiment was to show what most natural way, what way most of them go. Now everybody's got to do it, and now there's a right and wrong. Before, there wasn't any. It's like the best place to build a road across the moors, he said in English. We may first send people across and see which is the most natural way for them to go, and then build the road that way. Now, the example we gave of multiplication, and his remark about building a road, shows us Wittgenstein's attitude in this period to both mathematical propositions. Namely, and this is something completely new, mathematical propositions are regularities that have been hardened into rules. He didn't say that before, he didn't believe it before. So when we talk about grammar, we have to be very careful. Grammar, grammar, grammar. It means a different thing in this period when he talks about grammar. He's not talking about grammar in terms like my brother studies Hebrew grammar, syntax of Semitic languages, not that kind of rule. I mean, when he says 7 plus 5 plus, the grammatical rule means something completely different from that it's a syntactic rule, because in this period, these regularities are rules about not the syntax of language, but counting, measuring, and performing mathematical operations after training. They determine what is to be considered counting, measuring, and performing mathematical operations correctly. Correctly. Said again, I'm hopping to part six. The justification of proposition 25 times 25 is 625. I believe that this appears in Russell a couple of times as a is naturally that if anyone has been trained in such and such a way, then under normal circumstances he gets 625 as a result of multiplying 25 times 25. But the arithmetic proposition does not assert that. It is, so to speak, an empirical proposition hardened into a rule. It stipulates that the rule has been followed only when that is the result of the multiplication. Now look at the next sentence. It is thus withdrawn from being checked by experience, but now serves as a paradigm for judging experience. I see Kant on my shoulder, man. I see the ghost of you. I leave it to you, right? I'm not a Kant expert, but I'm sorry. Withdrawn from being checked, says Kant without transcendental ideal. Take away the transcendental, that's what you get. I have a colleague at the University who's a Kant scholar, Carl Fosey, who thinks that the notion of rule in Kant is just exactly this, and that's a lot closer than I want to make out. I'm saying nothing about this. Anyway, I can't go into this in depth, thank God. Oh, I will just, here's my main conclusion so far. This is the revolution. The relation between a rule and a regularity is exactly the same as the relation between a mathematical proposition and its canonical application. I say canonical application because Wittgenstein didn't know everything about mathematics. He didn't understand non-canonical application, but in the simple case that we're talking about, that's what he's talking about. Now, no time?
Well, I think we'll save about half an hour for discussion. I think we should close on time then.
When is that?
You've got another 7 to 8 minutes.
Okay. All right, so I will not be able to discuss what I came. What do you do about multiple proofs about the same theorem? How does that work in? I'll skip that. This, even though I wrote that special for this conference, but since I already told Felix over coffee what I think about this, I'll just say in 7 minutes I'll try to figure out when did this all happen. Granted that it happened, my next stage was doing a little empirical investigation. Now the problem in empirical investigation is it could be refuted. Usually in philosophy it doesn't actually have to be true, it just has to be possible. Here I have to say it has to be true. This is I'm taking a big risk, but let's see if within 6 minutes we can figure out when this happened, given that there is such a big revolution. We need to discuss the answer to Felix. Yeah? Instead, let's jump to when this all happened. Rudy, I actually paid for this disc. I did not steal it. It's 100% legal. It cost a fortune. I started looking through these stuff with my poor guy. I hired a graduate student. Let's begin by visiting Wittgenstein in August 1937 in a little house in, I can't pronounce it, either Skjolden, Norway. Not even his house. Though he had one there, he has a terrible shape physically and mentally. How do I know this? Using modern technology, I've been going through images of the private notebooks. It was like sitting with Wittgenstein in Anna Rebney's house in Skjolde, Norway. He had his own bungalow there. We call Jews call it a bungalow, a cabin. But he was so paranoid, he wasn't even going to live it. He's weak, feverish, full of thoughts about his own inadequacy and his moral degeneracy, pining after Francis Skinner. Now, he wasn't just his philosophical friend. But was afraid to go back to Cambridge because he wouldn't be able to work. Now, these thoughts he writes in a code. I don't know, those who have looked at these things, he didn't write this in regular German. He had this silly code, A is Z, B is... this code was invented by the Kabbalists in the 7th century. He's using this called Atbash, and he uses this. It's not very hard to decode, so I'm not exactly sure why he wrote these things in code. But on the 17th of August, he began to struggle with the Rufal and Paradox. This was the manuscript 118, 3R, and published as RFM 113. Wie weiß ich, this is related to my German. Felix actually pointed to this thing to say that Felix Stein does talk about knowledge sometimes, but it's really an ordinary. And most of you can read this. I will try to translate this into English. How do I know that in working out the series plus two, I must write 2004, 2006, and not 2004, 2008? The question, how do I know that this code is read, is similar. But you surely know that, for example, you must always write the same sequence of numbers in the units 2, 4, 6, 8, so you already had this rule-following paradox already in August 1937. Quite true. The problem must appear in that sequence and even in this one. 2, 2. No, Juliet Floyd's article, 2, 2, 2. For how do I know that I'm have to write 2 after 502? Etc., etc. If intuition is needed to continue the series plus 1, then it is also needed to continue the series plus 0. On the 20th of August, 1937, he enunciates for the first time the key to the solution of the so-called paradox, which is in the middle, Ben Manum.
What? It is tipped further back than the
if one has not thought of that consequence any more than he has of its contrary, with what right can one say that he meant that one? This has to do, no doubt, with the custom routine to play the game this way. I read this as empirical regularity. These are not instincts, by the way. They appear on training, and they can appear on a higher level when you learn rules of the game. Now, the next day, he begins writing in code three lines at the bottom. Starts, S is schwer. Da, 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 da. What does that mean? It is difficult to walk uphill, and one only does it with reluctance. I feel exceptionally weary. My body...
Okay, what's up? Did you change it before?
Yeah, this is Körper. That's okay. That means Körper, the Adbash, is clearly not in good shape. I feel as though I have extraordinary thoughts in me, but they can't reach the surface and at most come through for a moment and then disappear or withdraw if you translate again. On the other hand, I feel that in order to express these great thoughts, I would need a power such as I am far from possessing. In fact, I do not have the power to give birth to them, to squeeze them out, or that rather they crumble as they come out. That's in 21st of August, 1937. What are these great thoughts? This is the last paragraph. Escape near field vessel, he says. Translation. I am much better than yesterday. I can only still feel really like pains. I can once again enjoy the look at the view, and I am showered with gifts. But I misbehave, and I have mean and shabby pleasures and thoughts. Two letters from Drury and Skinner. The two are touchingly affectionate. How little deserved. A shabby man. Invite Francis to come over. May it turn out well. And may I be allowed to behave even half decently. I always want to believe God. Now on 21 December, Francis, I don't know if this is mixed company, I don't know if I should have to go into what happened on that. He didn't even remember, Wittgenstein could not even remember how many times he had intercourse with him. And usually remember a number like that, zwei oder drei Mal. And the monk thinks he had basically raped him. But it made him feel better, that's true. And right away after describing, saying that he's inviting Francis, he goes on to write this about God, receiving God. Yeah. I mean, I, like most of you, have been looking at this picture for years, right? But to see this figure writing this stuff about, I wanted to see God, that's sort of a little disconcerting. But there it is. Dry philosophy and mathematics, right in the middle of all kinds of stuff. But he's doing it, right? Here we have this figure. The truth is that I'm probably out of time. I will just have to take it from word. So he's now building his philosophy and mathematics right after this episode. This is a famous passage about how many strokes there were. The interpretation has to do with regularities, spiritual regularities, which are behind the arithmetic. No time right now to say this. And there's some more stuff. I mean, one day after another, he's getting closer and closer to the final thing. He starts with the note there in Clark, and then he puts two apples on the table, da da da, Moses. He has a business about apples, he has. Counting if these things didn't happen, there wouldn't be arithmetic at all. The sentence would have become unusable. Not that you could refute arithmetic, but it become unusable if the empirical regularity behind it disappears. Same thing again, 29 August, training, and all this stuff, all of the stuff is always falling into place. Here's the famous picture from Barton and the Foundation of Mathematics, which I don't have time to explicate in his life. But I admit, in an almost majority case, well, it's a result. Da, da, da. He's saying all this stuff. Right? You read this, you'll see. The whole thing is there. In other words, without having the time to go into each of these annotations in his diary one by one, but they're there. You can look at them. You know, we have the Nachlas. You can see if I'm right or wrong. This is one of the few episodes in history where you can actually point to an intellectual revolution in a person's mind and link it directly to his life. Why? Because Wittgenstein himself links it. You see, if I took Mozart and tried to say, oh, he wrote this symphony because he had problems with his wife, right? Maybe he did have problems with God, but what did it have to do with the symphony? You don't know. It's the creative mind that has nothing to do with it, right? Especially with like Moses. But if Wittgenstein, who's a genius, tells you, right, that I'm doing these ideas and I feel terrible and I have these sexual things, so maybe there's something to put together. And since we have this stuff on a specific date, August 21st, 1937, I put it to you that there is a revolution, and we know when it happened. Thank you.